as soon as we were introduced to the Bel Air House, it changed everything for us. There were things there that I could not see with my own eyes, and they were all around me. That was pretty scary to me. I felt surrounded. I was clearly surrounded, and I was not alone.
On the banks of the Ohio River, just across from West Virginia, is the small village of Bel Air, Ohio, a town rich in history from America's westward expansion. A stone railroad viaduct and an abandoned steel bridge sit idle as monuments to Bel Air's industrial past. But follow Route 7 heading south out of town, and you'll come across another piece of local history. An old two-story Victorian home set back from the road, referred to simply around town as Bel Air House, but known to others as one of the most haunted houses in America. Over the years, countless visitors have reported bizarre and sometimes horrifying experiences within the walls of this old house. I'm Steve French, and this is Unsolved Mysteries, The Haunting of Bel Air House. In 2005, Kristen Lee and her family are in desperate need of a new home. For the second time in 2 years, a flash flood has destroyed their house and all their possessions. Kristen, her two sons, Nicholas and Lane, and Lane's father, Jefe, have been staying with friends for months when a real estate listing catches Kristen's eye.
Being affected by two flash floods, we didn't have a very big budget. We were restarting our lives again. So I was at work and I was just scrolling through Belmont County Auditor's website for homes, and I scrolled to the Bel Air House, and it had been on a foreclosed list. So I thought that that would be great. A foreclosure, we would be able to, you know, manage money a little bit better and get a good deal.
The website gives Kristen little information about the house. She sees it's located in Bel Air, Ohio, and has 4 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms, the perfect size for her family. Looking at the photos, it appears to be rather old. However, the list price of $45,000 is something her family can afford, so she arranges for a tour.
It had a wraparound porch. It had a beautiful little woodworking on the arch of the front of the house, just like a little signature on the top of the house. It sits in front of the Ohio River. You could sit on the front porch and watch the river just flow, and that was perfect. The first thing that I noticed was the hutch in the dining room. It was a beautiful wooden floor-to-ceiling built-in hutch, and the beautiful fireplaces, the old 1800s fireplaces. They had marble inside them and cherry wood. The attic was, honest to goodness, it was just breathtaking. It had little windows with gables inside of the windows and wooden shutters. And I envisioned the kids like having a place to hang out and, you know, just have a boys' sanctuary. We also had a family dog named Bella. And we were excited because the house had such a large yard and it was all fenced in with privacy fence so Bella could run and the boys could play.
Kristen can't believe her luck. She puts in an offer on the house that evening, and it's accepted the following day. After 2 years of chaos and uncertainty, Kristen and her family can start to live a normal life again. But within a few weeks of moving in, Kristen begins to sense that Bel Air House is anything but normal.
There was some creepy things that happened in there, like sounds, noises, hearing these phantom footsteps and feeling like somebody is always has their eyes on you. Things would come up missing. Sometimes when you get out of the shower and you're like, where is my towel? I know I just put my towel here. Where did it go? And it wasn't the kids. It wasn't the dog. Things were just moved.
Kristen isn't the only one getting a strange vibe from their new home. Her 12-year-old son, Nicholas, complains of feeling a malevolent presence in his bedroom.
after a while, he did come to me and he said, I don't feel comfortable sleeping back here. He said, it just feels like there's eyes on me. It feels like somebody's watching me. So, you know, he started staying more and more with his grandmother about half an hour away.
Kristen has a master's of forensic psychology and is working as a mental health professional. She believes the eerie happenings in the house have a rational explanation. She attributes the feelings to exhaustion and stress. That is, until one terrifying night when the family is asleep.
It was wintertime, and because it was such a big house, we slept downstairs to save money on gas. It was time for bed. Everybody was asleep. Jefe was in the corner on the chair in the ottoman under the bookshelf, and Lane was on the wraparound couch with me on the other side of it. And we were sleeping soundly. I felt the cushion go down on the couch by my side, and I woke up. And when I opened up my eyes, there was a gray figure of a man. He was translucent, like a gray mist, so to speak. But there was physical features, and he had a flat affect. He had no expression. I screamed, "Who are you? What do you want? What are you doing here?" And no expression, nothing. Just staring at me. It was pretty creepy. Bella, our dog, was scrambling around the room. You know, her nails were tapping on the wooden floor. She was barking. To one point, I said, "Bella, calm down." And when I said that, I saw my breath. And it was cold, but it wasn't cold enough for my breath to come out of my mouth. So that was very strange. And then the man got up, and I felt the cushion come back up. The weight of the cushion, it just rose up again. And he walked through the living room into the foyer, and he vanished. After I tried to wrap my head around what happened, I physically got up and I shook Jefe and I was like, "I just saw a ghost." And he says, "You work too hard. You're too tired. Go back to sleep. You had a bad dream." And that's where we left it.
Could the ghostly gray man have been a stress-induced hallucination? Kristen doesn't think so. She's now convinced that the house is haunted and that her family needs to leave.
When I realized I'm not crazy, this isn't a delusion, this isn't a mental illness, and I knew at that point that we have to go.
Kristen puts the house up for sale and the family moves to a rental home, but no one is willing to buy their haunted home. To cover expenses, Kristen tries to use Belair House as a rental property.
Over the years, renters would come and go, and I was very honest with the renters. I said, "This house is haunted. You stay as long as you can. And if you can't stay, we understand." But they didn't stay. They left. And then I was stuck with the house again. Finally, I had just made a decision that due to the paranormal activity, that no family should live there.
So what do you do with a haunted house where no one wants to live? Kristen Lee comes up with a unique solution. She decides to transform her home into an afterlife research center and invites paranormal investigators from across the country to use it as a location for their work.
We've had people come in from Canada. We've had people come in from California, Texas. I mean, pretty much all of the United States. They travel. They just move in and they do their jobs, collect the data. You know, sometimes we hear back from them. Sometimes we don't.
I honestly don't even know how many times we have been to the Belair House.
Nicole Wilson and her friend Brandy Fulkerson are frequent visitors to Belair House. They refer to themselves as armchair paranormal investigators, and for nearly 15 years they have spent their spare time in eerie locations, searching for evidence of ghosts and spirits. Brandy believes their curiosity is a natural extension of their day jobs.
Nicole is a RN, and she's a labor and delivery nurse. I am an LPN and I work with geriatrics. So we kind of joke around that, you know, she brings people into the world and I take people out.
Of all the places they've investigated, Belair House has captured Brandy and Nicole's attention like no other. They make the 6-hour trip from upstate New York to eastern Ohio several times each year, hoping to encounter paranormal activity. They have never been disappointed.
I didn't know much about the house prior to going. There was five of us that had gone. Three girls from Canada and Nicole and myself. The house sits on top of a hill. It's an older looking Victorian home. It looks run down. The porch has fallen apart and the fence has fallen apart. It's very creepy.
The first time we walked into the Bel Air house was a bit overwhelming. This was very early in our investigation career, so to say. I was feeling very scared because of the anticipation of things that could happen. I am literally afraid of my own shadow. And when we go places and we go to investigate, Brandy usually is more or less kind of not holding my hand, but holding me like, come on, you're okay, come on. I have slowly gotten better, but I'm just terrified the entire time.
My first instinct, like when I walked into the house, is it was inviting. But then as night came and it got darker, the house was more intense. It made a lot of noise all the time. There was always something going on. But every time that we would go, there would be a completely different feeling behind it.
While conducting investigations at Bel Air House, Brandy and Nicole have experienced all kinds of paranormal activity, unexplained sounds, mysterious lights, and ghostly apparitions.
One of the times that Nicole and I were at the Bel Air House, it was just the two of us. We were there overnight, and Nicole kept saying, when are we going to leave? And that was the first night that I said, the house will tell us when we're going to leave. And the house most certainly told us when it was time to go. We were sitting on the couch, and out of nowhere, we just heard this huge crash. I mean, it sounded as if somebody took a huge bookcase full of books and just knocked it over on the floor above us. The whole entire house shook. I was scared to death. My legs were like jello. I don't think that I could have gotten out of there fast enough. I do know that I left a few personal belongings behind, and I was okay with that.
To Kristen Lee, the owner of Bel Air House, Brandy and Nicole's reaction that night was not surprising or uncommon.
There was quite a few teams that could not last the night. They would be so excited when they got there, and they were so excited to investigate. But 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I would get a phone call and they would say, hey, we're not going to make it. We're locking up. Joe was pushed down the steps. Mary was scratched. We've had enough.
When we first get to the Bel Air House, we always do a walkthrough of the house. We walk upstairs, look in each and every room, just kind of looking to see how the house is when we walk in. And that's something we would do normally, is put a ball on the stairs just to, you know, ask anything if they could push it down. And it's just kind of a way to know if something is happening in that area. So this particular day after our walkthrough, we're just sitting in the living room talking. And suddenly the ball came flying down the stairs. And when I say flying, like it flew up and hit the ceiling and bounced off the ceiling and then hit the bottom of the stairs. So it wasn't just a rolling down the stairs from the house creaking or anything like that. It was full on thrown. So that kind of set me for a scary little loop.
Sherry Eimer is a paranormal investigator who lives in the area. So she's had plenty of opportunities to visit Bel Air House over the years.
One night in the attic, it was me and two other people. We just was sitting there with the recorder doing a investigation. Then all of a sudden, just up out of the floor, this thing like slithered. Just looked like a black cloud, like snake looking thing. And it just slithered past us and into the dark. Then all of a sudden you'd see it come back. And it did that like 3 or 4 times right past our feet. I actually put my feet up on the couch and it just freaked me out. I'd think somebody was crazy if they told me that, if I didn't see it with my own eyes.
A thunderous sound, a mysterious flying ball, a snake-like apparition. Could these bizarre encounters be evidence of paranormal activity? Frightened but undeterred, Nicole, Brandy, and Sherry returned to search for answers. In March of 2019, armed with an array of cameras, audio recorders, and paranormal research equipment, they arrive at Belair House for another weekend investigation.
We were at the Belair House. We had spent the night. We had all of our equipment set up.
We had placed cameras all through the upstairs of the Belair House so that Brandy and I would be able to just sit in the living room, watch the two TV monitors to watch what's going on upstairs without actually having to be upstairs. We were watching the monitors and we saw something in a bedroom. And Brandy was like, "What is that light in the bedroom?" So we were paying close attention to that.
The investigators try to communicate with the mysterious light in the bedroom.
"We will ask for the light to go away. It seems to comply. The light goes on, the light goes off, it flickers, and we're just very intrigued in what's going on in the screen. Then all of a sudden, it just stops moving. There is no light." Dead silence at that point. A few minutes goes by and the EMF detector goes off. Nicole turns around and says, "Guys, I think that the chairs at the table have been moved out." And we look, and two of the chairs that were at the dining room table have been moved away from the table. When Nicole and I were on our way home and we were just going through the audio, listening to that in the car, we captured something that we have no explanation for what it is, why it occurred, and why we did not know at the time that it had occurred.
What follows is the actual audio recording captured on site by Brandy and Nicole.
There's like, you see that, like a little light with a little dot?
Yeah.
It keeps going away. Oh, see?
Yeah, at the bottom, right?
See it in the fireplace?
Yeah, I see it.
In this audio clip, you can clearly hear us watching the monitor, talking about the light that's going on.
The top right, it looked like something flickered underneath the bed, like right past the ball.
It got quiet. And then you can hear a conversation that we never heard with our own ears.
It's only when they play back the audio recording that Brandy and Nicole hear what their instruments picked up from the upper floor of the empty Belair House.
It sounded like two males that were just hanging out, joking around, talking about four-wheelers or driving motorcycles. They were laughing. One guy actually burped. And as the conversation ended is when all of our equipment started going off.
"Check those dining room chairs because I'm pretty sure they've been moving around."
It's something different that I've never come across before. And it is so clear, this conversation, that how did we not hear this with our own ears?
Given the sheer number and variety of paranormal encounters at the Belair House, Nicole believes it's more than just haunted.
I feel like the Belair House is just a magnet of spiritual activity. It attracts all of this energy. It's definitely haunted. It definitely has spirits there, but it's not just a haunted house.
In fact, between history and local legend, Belair House's dark past reads like the opening to a horror film. Built in 1847 by a coal tycoon named Jacob Hetherington, the property is directly adjacent to sacred Native American burial caves, and was the scene of a massacre during the French and Indian War. At one point, the house was used to smuggle freed slaves to the north as part of the Underground Railroad, and it sat on top of a working coal mine.
There was an explosion in that coal mine, and it killed a lot of people in the community. Does that open up something in the Bel Air house? You know, does that open up a portal for different things to come on through?
According to local legend, the Hetherington family was soon stricken by mysterious tragedies. Around the time of the explosion, Jacob's son Alex moved into the house with his daughter Lyde. A short time later, Alex began to experience seizures and hallucinations. He was committed to an asylum after claiming that demons were trying to kill him. Lyde Hetherington assumed responsibility for the business and Bel Air house, and her younger brother Edwin returned to Bel Air to help. When Lyde died suddenly in the dining room, Edwin was left alone in the house, grief-stricken and desperate.
The brother would hold seances in this house to try to connect with his sister. So some people feel that this is what has opened the house to the paranormal world.
It truly is just a constant source of energies, earthbound spirits, entities that just filter in and out of the house.
Kristen Lee believes that many of the paranormal encounters are communications from spirits who had, at one point in time, a connection to the house. Some are friendly spirits. Some are not. Take, for example, a spirit that goes by the name of Emily Davis. She supposedly drowned in the Ohio River when she was a little girl.
Emily Davis is a little girl that drowned in the Ohio River. And we can correlate her to the founder of Bel Air, Jacob Davis. The Emily Davis that poses as a child, we do not believe that that is a child. 9 times out of 10, she will gain your trust. You will think you're talking to a child. And maybe an hour later, horrible things will happen. Growls, scratches, being pushed. She's not a child. She's just not.
According to Kristen, Emily Davis's room is possibly the most active location for paranormal activity in the entire house. Nicole and Brandy claim some of their most disturbing encounters have centered around that room.
On one occasion, we had lost a flashlight. One of the girls from Canada, Amy, was with us. And Amy, myself, and what I thought was Nicole, was going upstairs to locate it. When we got to the top of the stairs, Amy was in front of me and she turned into Emily Davis's room. I went behind her and out of the corner of my eye, I saw Nicole continue on straight down the hall. So I yelled out her name and I didn't hear an answer. And I just thought, where is she going? Because that's really brave of her to go to another room by herself. So I called her name again, still no answer. The third time, I yelled her name. And from downstairs in the living room, I heard her say, "What?" I immediately froze. My eyes filled up with tears, and they just started streaming down my face.
I was downstairs in the living room area. Brandy started yelling. And yelling, and I finally yelled back up, you know, "What? What do you need?" And she just simply said nothing. I was like, okay. And just carrying on. And when Brandy came down the stairs, her eyes were full of tears. I could see the fear in Brandy's eyes when she was looking at me. And I said, "Brandy, what's the matter?"
And I said, "Were you upstairs? Did you follow me upstairs?" And she said, "Girl, you know I sit on this couch. I'm not going anywhere." Every hair stood up on my arms, my legs, my back, my neck. The vision that I had of Nicole, she had on white pants and a black shirt, and her hair was in a ponytail. Downstairs, my friend Nicole was wearing just the opposite. She was wearing a pair of black pants and a white shirt, and her hair was in a ponytail. And I think that freaks Nicole out more than anything, and especially going to that house, because it was her that I saw.
Was this entity some kind of hallucination? Or could the doppelganger indicate the presence of something darker within the house? A terrifying experience during a different investigation offers a clue.
We were there overnight, and a friend had called us, and he's always wanted to come with us, but never had the same time off. And he asked if I could give him a tour of the house. So I took my cell phone, I turned the camera around so that he could see the house, and I gave him a tour of the entire house. I had hung up with him, and I want to say about an hour later or so, he had sent Nicole a message and said, "You need to turn on the lights in the house." So of course that just freaks her out. She asked, like, what is going on? And he said, "What you didn't know is when Brandy was giving me the tour of the house, I was taking screenshots. Then I'm going to send them to you, but I need you to turn on the lights in the house." There was a few different things that he had captured in these pictures. The first one, I was walking up the stairs from the first floor, and he had taken a picture of down the hall. And there was nothing in that picture. 3 seconds later, he had taken another picture when I got to the top of the stairs, and it appears to be a family that is standing in the hall. The picture shows a man, a woman, and what appears to be a child with long hair and a nightgown. I did not see this during the tour. This was something only his camera captured. So as I got to the top of the stairs, I turned to my left. There is a bedroom on my left. It's Emily Davis's room, and there's a lot of different activity that happens in that room. When I faced that room, there is one picture where you can see light from my phone kind of reflecting off of the door handle. But if you look in the lower part of the picture, I'm not sure what that is. But there is definitely something inhuman in that picture. A complete face.
Is the horrifying face captured in that image an optical illusion or a manifestation of some other entity that calls Belair House home?
The one thing I can tell you that has never left, ever, since I moved in until today, it's still there. It is this very negative energy, maybe inhuman. I don't know for sure. It's just not an earthbound spirit, and we cannot identify what it is. But it has scratched people. It has pinned people down to their beds. It's pushed people. It's made people become very weak. It can be dormant. It can sit dormant. But it always comes back.
As Brandy completes the video tour, she returns to the landing by the stairs where another investigator claimed to have been pushed during a recent visit, breaking a window in the process.
I had pulled the curtain back to show him the busted window, and he had taken another picture. In that picture, you clearly see 2 red eyes behind me. As soon as I was able to review those pictures, I definitely wanted to leave the house. The sense that there were things there that I could not see with my own eyes, and they were all around me, that was pretty scary to me. I believe that Nicole actually started crying, and she wanted to leave immediately. So we did. We really do listen to that house. And it lets us know when it's time to go.
Brandy and Nicole continue to make the long trek to Ohio several times a year. The connection they feel to Belair House has proven to be more powerful than their fear.
Brandy will always say, "Oh, I feel like Belair House is calling to us. I think we need to plan a trip." It could be on a whim within a few weeks. We're like, "All right, we're going. You know, we're taking off for a 6-hour road trip." We keep doing this drive so often because of the fact that every time we go there, we get something new. We get more evidence. We get a new EVP. There's always a new experience.
I'm very, very drawn to this house. There are times that I will wake up and I will have dreamt about the house, and then I will call Nicole and say, we need to go back. It's almost as like if it's calling out to us to come back.
Everybody that comes to the house is just like, we're just so drawn to this house. We're just so drawn to this energy. And when they walk in, it's they always say, it's like we've been here before. This is so familiar.
For Kristen, that feeling of connection is what drew her to Belair House in the first place. Perhaps the strange forces that attract so many spirits from the past also call out to the living, seeking to make them a part of its history as well.
I just have so many questions about this house. Every time you go into that house, you leave with more questions than you do answers. My goal is just to get answers of what happens in the afterlife. You know, being a nurse and working with geriatrics, and I see so many people pass, it's like, what happens to them when they're gone? And then what's going to happen to me when I'm gone? I guess I'm just really looking for answers.
Today, Belair House continues to be a destination for paranormal researchers and others seeking clues to the mysteries of the afterlife. If you have experienced a haunting or have a mystery of your own to share, submit your story at unsolved.com. Next on Unsolved Mysteries.
There's two mysteries in this case. The second mystery will be to solve who killed Jane Arroyo Grande Doe. The first mystery is to solve who Jane Arroyo Grande Doe is.
Unsolved Mysteries is a production of Cosgrove Muir Productions and Cadence 13. It is executive produced by Terry Dunmuir and Chris Corcoran. Produced by Lloyd Lockridge, Christine Lennig, Courtney Ennis, Paige Heimson, and Paul Yates. The story producer for this episode was Caitlin Cutt, and it was edited by Keith Shea. From Cadence 13, editing, mixing, and mastering by Chris Basil, Andy Jaskowitz, and Bill Schultz. Production support by Sean Cherry and Ian Mont. Artwork and design is by Kurt Courtney. Publicity by Josephina Francis and Hilary Schuff. The original theme music was composed by Gary Malkin and Michael Boyd. Thanks for listening to episode 29 of Unsolved Mysteries.